The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Hi, I'm Mark Juergensmeyer, Director of the Orfila Center of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And today we have a wonderful guest. We have with us Ambassador Barbara Bodine, who's had a distinguished career with the State Department. She served as the ambassador to Yemen at the time of the USS Cole attack. She was the first high-level diplomat and administrator to come into Baghdad after the invasion and occupation of the country to help with the reconstruction. She's had an extraordinary background. Here to tell about those instances and what went right and what went wrong in the reconstruction of Iraq. But first of all, Ambassador Bodine, welcome back to Santa Barbara, because it all started here, right?
It did indeed. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me back. I'm delighted to be here. And yes, it all started at Santa Barbara.
Many years ago, you were an undergraduate.
I was an undergraduate here. I actually got 2 degrees, poli-sci and Asian studies. And I've always been very, very pleased that I chose Santa Barbara as my undergraduate. It was a perfect place for me to go.
Well, we're grateful to hear that. But you were not in Middle Eastern studies when you were at Santa Barbara, right?
I'm not even sure there was Middle Eastern studies at Santa Barbara then, but no, my interest was entirely in Asia. My concentration was China and India. I spent 4 years studying Chinese and even was able to go on the junior year abroad program to Hong Kong for a year.
So then it was the wisdom of the State Department having all this knowledge of East Asia and this facility in Chinese to send you to the Middle East?
In defense of the State Department, they were actually opposed to my changing bureaus. They wanted me to stay in Asia.
Oh, so you started off actually going to East Asia.
My first 3 tours were in Asia, in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Bangkok. So yes, we were using all of my background. I decided that I wanted to take a look at another part of the world, that I had been concentrating on Asia since I was an undergraduate, and arranged an assignment in the Middle East Bureau, ironically working on Yemen and the Arabian Peninsula, and was going to do that for 2 years and go back to Asia, and I got absolutely intrigued with the Middle East and never went back.
And studied Arabic, learned the culture?
State Department said, you know, would love to have you join the Middle East Bureau, but the rites of passage are 2 years of intensive Arabic. So I went through that.
Now, I know you also had experience in Washington, head of counterterrorism for the State Department, dean of the School of Foreign Service. But then you were drawn back to Yemen to be the ambassador.
Right. I got a call one afternoon. It was, I believe, in April of 97, asking me if I would agree to be the ambassador to Yemen, as they very graciously put it. And, of course, I said yes in nanosecond.
And you thought this was going to be a nice, calm experience, a quiet, enjoying the culture of the people. And then along came the USS Cole attack.
I'm not really quite sure that I thought it was going to be quiet and calm. Nothing in the Middle East is ever quiet or calm, and certainly not my career. We actually had a very interesting time for the first 3 years as we took the Yemen relationship from what was really just in the deep freeze. We had no relationship with Yemen at all when I got there. And after 3 years, we had built it into a very healthy, multifaceted relationship.
So in some ways, you were the right person to be there at a very bad time. It is the time of the attack. You could deal with the government, but were you actually there at the time of the attack?
I was not there at the time of the attack. I wasn't even supposed to be in Yemen at that point. My assignment was supposed to be up the summer before, and my successor was not confirmed by the Senate, and so I was asked if I would stay for another year, which I absolutely said yes to. At that time, I thought, oh, I'm going to get a fourth year. I can spend my time going to parts of the country and seeing things that I hadn't seen before. And I was on consultations in Washington.
Oh, I see. So physically, you were in Washington at the time of the attack. So you read in the papers? Or
no. Physically, I was on an airplane.
Oh.
And, flying from Chicago to Sana'a, believe it or not. Huh. And the attack happened sometime in between. And so when I landed in Sana'a that night.
That's the capital of Yemen.
The capital of Yemen, sorry. The attack had been at about 10 o'clock in the morning. I arrived at 11 o'clock that night. Uh-huh. That was the very first that I had heard.
Walking off the airplane.
I had no idea.
You said, oh, guess what, Ambassador Modine? All hell is breaking loose.
It was about that. My deputy met me at the airplane, and my deputy had never met me at the airplane. And it had to be bad news. I just didn't know what kind.
Okay.
He started off with, one of our ships has blown up in the harbor. And I think, like a lot of people, my assumption or my instinctive hope was that there had been some horrible
accident.
Industrial accident.
Right.
And then he went and, revised his verb and said, has been blown up. And, of course, that was entirely different.
Right.
And it just, started moving from there.
Did you instantly know it was Al-Qaeda?
I think it was
instinctively,
yes. I mean, it was a process of elimination. It was a very sophisticated attack. It was very well planned. And there really isn't any other group operating in the region that could have done it. I mean, the IRA or the Baath separatists are not going to blow up a U.S. ship in Aden Harbor. So it had to be Al-Qaeda.
So I assume your first task was not just dealing with the American investigatory agencies, but also dealing with the Yemeni government.
Well, yes. My very first task was I had just gotten off an airplane, and my first task was to get on another airplane and fly down to Aden. And
right,
I was there by, I think, 4 o'clock that morning.
Wow. So you had no sleep. You had no sleep on the airplane, and there you were. Oh, my God.
I had no sleep at about 2 days at that point, by the time I arrived in Aden. And my very first responsibility was to go out to the ship, and I was out at on the coal, literally at sunrise.
The day after the attack, that's pretty good.
Yeah, So it was probably about 18 hours after the attack I was out there. So, and I will always remember driving there and coming around a corner and seeing this Aegis cruiser, which is the most sophisticated ship in the U.S. Navy, and it was literally listing badly to one side. And seeing a ship like that badly crippled was an unbelievably devastating sight. So my first thought was to tour the ship. My second stop was to go. The president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was in residence in Aden coincidentally, and so as soon as I had finished with the ship, my second stop was to go talk to the president of the country.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What was it like to deal with the Yemeni government? Were they very sympathetic? Were they very helpful? Or were they suspicious or what?
No, they were as horrified as we were.
In some ways it was an attack on them as well as on the United States.
Well, they very much saw it as an attack on them as well. And they were horrified on a personal level. They were angry on a kind of a political level because they did see it as an attack on them. The very first thing that the president assured me of was their full and complete cooperation on basically anything that we needed. And we did have some problems along the way putting together the 21st century FBI technology and a extraordinarily rudimentary investigative service that Yemen had is obviously going to be difficult.
Yeah.
But the very first thing that I did get from the president was that they saw this as much of an attack on them as on us, and that their full cooperation was something that he would guarantee.
And there you were, kind of caught between the American government and the American investigating agencies and the Yemeni government, and somehow trying to keep them from getting each other's hair and killing each other.
Well, yes. I mean, I think I guess my job I really saw was kind of trying to meld the two, and to explain to the Americans who were coming in to either do the investigation, provide force protection. I mean, our first responsibility, of course, was to recover the ship and the crew, and to kind of act as a go-between between what the American government in its various aspects needed and what the Yemeni government in its limited capacity could do, and to keep it moving forward. There were obviously going to be strains and differences and miscommunication, and at any point any of these could have derailed what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. And my job was to keep that from happening.
So then after the Yemen experience, you got a wonderful green pastures. They allowed you to be an ambassador in residence, and you chose UC Santa Barbara.
Absolutely.
So you came and you were here in Santa Barbara for 2 years, teaching mm-hmm. and enjoying mm-hmm. everything that we have to offer. And you thought Yemen was probably the toughest assignment you would have until one day you received a phone call.
Well, I think it was rather interesting because I had actually arranged my diplomat in residence here on that trip before the call. Hmm. And so I already had this. And there were days, I can tell you, in Yemen when, you know, knowing that Santa Barbara was out there, if I could just survive long enough to get to Santa Barbara, I would be fine. But
did you have a clue they were going to call you up and send you to Baghdad?
I didn't have any clue at all. And you all very nicely let me teach a course on, it was called Interventionism, Limits and Opportunities.
Right, you were teaching a course
on interventionism, on when does it work and why doesn't it work,
country,
and humanitarian
right.
intervention, military intervention, and everything was great. And one day, I was actually at LAX airport on my way on some trip, I got a phone call from Deputy Secretary of State Rich Armitage saying, "We want you back in Washington now." And
you said, "Oh,
and
why?"
No, my your first answer is yes, and then you ask why. Mm. And I came back here. I didn't. Because I was at Los Angeles Airport, I went to the frequent flyer lounge. I don't want to give a ad. the airline I was on, and rerouted myself and literally flew straight from LAX to Washington, which I had not planned on doing.
Right.
And when I got there, it was, we need a senior State Department person to join the Department of Defense reconstruction effort. You're one of the very few people who has served in Iraq, who has done interagency crisis work. And so, you know, the Secretary of State asks you, now, would you be willing to? And of course, your answer is yes. So I missed my last class in interventionism and had to explain to my students.
Well, I've been meaning to speak with you about that.
I know.
We're expecting you to come back and teach those final lectures.
Well, you know, I did actually get through. I did grade the finals.
Oh, good. But you did have a good excuse. And you were part of the reconstruction team mm-hmm. with General Garner, and you were mm-hmm. to be in charge of Baghdad. And
I had Baghdad and the central governance, which...
the most critical area of Iraq.
What we now call the Sunni Triangle, yeah. And it was all of this. It was about 40% of the Iraqi population.
But you had served in Iraq before, so you
right.
knew it. You knew what you were getting into. You'd been to Baghdad.
I didn't know all of what I was getting into, but I had served there for almost 3 years in the early 80s. And so I had some familiarity with Baghdad. I knew the Iraqis. I had Arabic. And so... brought something
like
to the table.
Absolutely the right person for the position.
Well, that's what the State Department seemed to think. So.
And you had some ideas of what should have been done, right? And.
Well, I think like a lot of us who were military, State Department, even third country nationals, British, Australians, others, one of my major concerns, and I voiced this at some conferences that were at Santa Barbara prior to the invasion, my major concern was that I was not seeing any evidence of any, you know, day after planning. That we had a great idea for invading the country, and we had no idea what we were going to do the day after.
You would think you would know if anybody would know.
Well, I was called back to Washington and discovered that we didn't have any plan. And the day I was called back by Washington to see if I would even join the reconstruction effort.
And this was how long before the invasion?
February 27th of 2003. I joined the Reconstruction effort on March 2nd of 03. So prior to March 2nd, there was no one who was responsible for coordinating Baghdad and the central governance. It was astonishing, absolutely astonishing. I had no staff. I had no mission. It was basically, it's yours. Figure out what you want to do.
I mean, you could just design a reconstruction plan.
Well,
you had no choice.
On one level, I had no staff to do it with. And
but did you quickly get a staff?
Well, I was able to sort of cobble things together and, you know, made phone calls to people I knew to see if either they would join me or they knew someone who would join me. And I had to kind of sort of plot out what are my basic responsibilities and therefore who do I need to head those and then recruit them. But we left for Kuwait within 2 weeks.
My God.
And of course, being in Santa Barbara, I didn't know quite all of the level of guerrilla warfare going on in Washington. But there was a plan for Iraq. The problem was that we weren't allowed to use it. And
explain that. What do you mean?
Well, for 18 months prior to the decision to go into Iraq, the State Department had headed up an interagency, actually even international, planning effort. It was called the Future of Iraq Project. 250 Iraqis, all elements of the U.S. government, some experts from outside the U.S., to sit down and think through, you know, what do you do in terms of post-conflict reconstruction?
Right.
Not the physical reconstruction so much as the political, economic reconstruction. And after 18 months, and this was congressionally funded and National Security Council mandated, so we weren't doing this on the sly,
right.
There was a plan that was about 4 feet worth of binders.
Huh.
And it went through everything that you can imagine in rebuilding a country after 30 years of a dictatorship and an invasion. And the Department of Defense's policy was that the plan did not exist. The planners did not exist.
I mean, were they literally ignorant of the fact that the State Department had it?
Oh, they were very much aware of the fact. It was a policy decision by the Department of Defense not to use the plan.
Huh.
And in many ways, to my mind, more inexplicable not to use the planners.
Huh.
Eisenhower once said that the value of a plan is not the plan, but the planning.
Right.
By extension, the planners.
Right.
And anyone who had been involved in the Future of Iraq Project, U.S. government, academic, Iraqi, were not included in the Department of Defense's efforts.
Why? Did they feel like they were too soft on the Baathists?
I don't know. It's kind of hard to believe that they thought that Iraqi exiles and people who had lived in Iraq could possibly
like
Chalabi, you know, could be soft on Saddam or the Baathis. We did have a group centered at the Department of Defense, not wholly, but centered at the Department of Defense, that had a very clear idea about what they wanted to do and how they wanted to do it. And they basically kind of, you know, to borrow Frank Sinatra, they were going to do it their way.
Right.
And they were...
I mean, they were listening to people like Chalabi, but not these other people who were involved.
They would listen to Chalabi, they would listen to Kanan Makiya, they would listen to some others who were in the exile community, but it was a very small group.
Mm-hmm.
They excluded State Department experts, they excluded the CIA experts. I mean, it was a fairly broad group of people who were excluded. So.
Well, this could explain why they got unhappy with you after a while, but I'm getting ahead of the
yeah.
story. Let's go back then to you're in Kuwait.
Yeah.
The invasion is taking place.
Absolutely.
You're watching it on CNN.
Absolutely.
And you're cooling your heels in a hotel in Kuwait.
Right.
And you're saying, okay, you're looking at your watch, and about time to go to Baghdad.
Well, we didn't know quite how quickly we were going to go. In fact, when we went to Kuwait in March, about 3 or 4 days before the invasion, we actually thought we were going to go in sooner.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that was the first big red flag that this was not going to go according to whatever plan we had
mm-hmm.
was, of course, watching the looting on CNN.
Oh, yeah.
And realizing that One of the working assumptions of the Department of Defense approach was that there would be a fully functioning government, civil service, offices, everything would be there.
Kind of seamless transition.
Kind of on pause.
That
we would come in and we would hit the pause button and off everything would go.
Right.
And the problem was, watching CNN, there were no office buildings left. I mean, everything was being trashed. And the presumption of a functioning city and a functioning government, that we would just go in and kind of tweak at the top and then turn over, just it was disintegrating in
front of us. So it's like nobody thought about the need for civil order after the military?
There really wasn't. There really wasn't. The idea was, and this existed all the way into the middle of May, was that we would be able to go in and just do some, as I said, some minor tweaking at the top, and our political reconstruction would be finished by August. Our infrastructure reconstruction would be finished by August, that there would be a sovereign government by August. And as late as early May, our military was on an accelerated redeployment program, which is astonishing now that you think that we're on a surge.
Right.
They really did believe that we could be out of Iraq militarily, politically, by the fall of 2003.
In and out, mission accomplished.
That was
That's it.
It.
And the fully functioning government would be
everything
set
in place. Fine. Right. I mean, they were going to have a constitution,
right?
Elections,
right?
A fully sovereign government in approximately 4 months. We have not been able to accomplish it in 4 years.
So nobody even thought about the possibility of civil collapse or a total disorder. When you saw that, did you call, pick up the phone, and say, "Hey, you know, get some of these troops in there, redeploy them, get them out in the streets, protect the government"?
I didn't get on the phone. I walked next door. I mean, we were all in Kuwait, and all of the people who were responsible for this were at a hotel that was a series of villas, and I just went right next door to the one that General Garner and others were at, and we just walked in and said, you know, we've got looting going on, we've got civil chaos going on, you know, what are we going to do about it? And so it wasn't even a phone call. It was, a two-minute walk.
So why didn't something then happen?
I think that's going to be one of the great questions that's going to be hanging out there. It was a decision, not supposed to use a passive voice, but it was a decision taken in Washington that we were not going to involve ourselves in this. And I think it's important
in this meaning
in this,
civil
in the,
order.
In the civil order, in the reconstruction.
Having just brought down the government and totally destroyed any kind of basis of
basically,
civil order.
Basically what we did is that we kind of pulled the bones out of the body politic.
Right.
And we were surprised when the body then collapsed.
Right.
And however diseased those bones might have been, they still were holding up the government.
So the reconstruction team was sitting in Kuwait saying, "You got to do something," and the Pentagon was saying, "Not our job."
Absolutely. And it was, we're fine, we're going to go ahead with the plan. And this is one of the problems, is that, and I think we've seen this over the last 4 years, we don't adapt to changing situations. And this was the plan. This is what we're going to do.
So when were you then allowed to go to Baghdad? You're sitting
there
watching
all this. We went to Baghdad shortly after the statue fell. Found a city in far more disarray than we had been led to believe.
Was there any kind of order at that point? Were there troops trying to...
There was really almost no order. We weren't quite at that level. When I was there, I was out of the green zone every single day.
You could travel around the city.
I traveled around the city. I was meeting with the Iraqis. I was working with the mayoralty that ran the city. Mm-hmm. So we were out and around, but we were starting to see the precursors to the insurgency. And we were, you know, being very clear to both the leadership in Baghdad and certainly trying to get back to Washington that if we didn't get the security situation under control, we were never going to be able to get the services up and running. And that the lack of law and order, the basic lack of law and order, was going to undo whatever we thought we could accomplish. And they really simply kind of didn't want to hear it. You have to remember, we were still in our liberator, not occupier phase. And there was this fervent belief that somehow this government could run itself.
But I remember you telling me that when you got there, the buildings had been stripped bare.
The building, I know, the buildings were stripped bare.
They literally even took the wiring out of the
walls. Oh, they were pulling the wiring out of the walls. Right. They took all the equipment. The civil servants, the technocrats, were all in hiding. I mean, they had all gone home to stay home. They didn't know who they were working for. There was nothing to work with. But, you know, this is an administration that, prior to even coming in, I mean, during the campaign for the 2000 election, we don't do nation building. Well, in a sense, they adhered to that.
But if you destroyed a government, you've got to do something to replace it.
There was I believe that there was this idea, this belief, that you could do regime change without doing nation building. And that essentially what we did in the spring of 2003 was regime change. And that's all we were going to do. And this idea that functioning government would appear on its own, which anyone who's taking Poli-Sci 101 knows is not going to happen. But but you could do that. Those two were separate. And there was also, you know, a plan to impose a government. I'm still 4 years later working on this concept of imposed democracy, which has
always... Did you know about that at the time?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I mean, we knew about the plan to bring in primarily exile leaders who really had no roots in Iraq and set them up as a government. And this assumption that the Iraqi people would somewhat passively accept... you know, a government of our choosing, a timetable of our choosing, a government structure of our choosing, that that we could come in and basically order all of this. And
so what did you do at the time, and what is it that you would have liked to have done if you could have done anything you wanted to?
Well, yes, if I mean, what my primary responsibility was to see if I could get Baghdad City up and running.
Right.
And it's important to remember...
It's pretty big. It's 6 million people.
It's 6-7 million
no people. No government suddenly.
Nothing. And it's 25...
Garbage piling on the streets, no electricity, no...
It's 25%, 30% of the population of a country of a population about the size of California. Yeah. So somebody figured out that I was responsible for the equivalent of Los Angeles or the Mexican border. And I had 15 people working for me. Yeah. Our first... order of business was to try to figure out how to get services up and running, because there weren't any. The one thing that I did begin that I think if it had been allowed to work and really get itself going might have made a difference, is I was trying to set up local neighborhood councils, you know, that would both help us design the reconstruction. The people in the neighborhoods are going to know what services they need more than we do. It would also be kind of a grassroots democracy. It would be
give them a sense that there was something going on.
Well, it would give them a sense of control over their own lives.
Right.
It would give us the most immediate feedback on, you know, what do you need us to do. It would preempt outside forces.
Brilliant idea. What happened to that?
What I was told when I was pushing this, I got it almost started. But the basic answer to me was, we're not going to be here long enough to do a bottom-up democracy. We're going to be doing a top-down democracy.
Oh, so they literally thought you'd be out by the end of the year.
Oh, we were going to be out by the end of August. We were going to be finished by the end of August. We the reconstruction, the political reconstruction, by the end of August, 2003. So we're not going to be here long enough to do this.
My goodness.
And, you know, one of those great, there's a PhD dissertation out there, you know, what would have happened if, because I think you had the ability to do this on a neighborhood basis. And I think you would have developed local leadership. There would have been an indigenous leadership. And one of the things that's come out of the Iraq Study Group and also the NIE that the intelligence community just released is there isn't really a very strong indigenous leadership.
Right.
Well, by not doing anything to encourage it from the bottom up, we kind of truncated that process.
Right.
So, you know, one of those great what ifs, if we had done this 4 years ago, what might we have now?
And I think also you wanted to involve at least some of the old administrators from the Ba'ath Party that were around. You also wanted to make sure that the old Saddam army didn't just dissipate and create militias around the country.
Yeah, we were already seeing the beginnings of militias, of rogue militias, and that was a concern to our military.
Right.
And our military wanted to shut down the militias and didn't get any support from Washington.
Wait a second. They want the military itself. Our generals saw that there was a problem emerging with the militias, and they wanted to nip it in the bud. And the Pentagon said no.
Yes, they said no. They did not give any backing. What we were trying to do on our civilian side, and which I know a little bit better, is in when I went into the mayoralty, all of the people running this huge city. My first line to them was, you know, I don't care if you belong to the Ba'ath Party or not. Mm-hmm. I care if you are corrupt. I care if you are competent. I care if you are either serving the people or abusing your power. Mm-hmm. Those are the criteria on which I will judge you. Ba'ath Party, I don't care. Because I understood that there were people who had to join the party basically to survive. And that was our basic approach, is that we knew that the really high-level people, the mayor of Baghdad, were long gone. So we weren't seeing high-level people. They weren't going to stick around and work for us.
Sure.
So let's put that to one side, and let's go for competency.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, was overturned in late May. And a lot of attention, rightly, is put on the effect of the demobilization, of getting rid of the Iraqi military and police and borders. I think equally damaging was the de-Ba'athification, because it went so far down.
Right.
It affected almost every level of government. We used to joke about, not really joke, but it went so far as elementary school librarians.
Oh.
We basically disenfranchised all of the technocrats.
So anybody who knew how to do anything, who had to run anything, were
was
not
out.
Allowed to do so and not be a part of the Reconstruction.
Exactly.
I remember talking with you before you went to Iraq, and you had some ideas about talking with people in other embassies to try to get a sense
mm-hmm.
of who we could trust and who we could deal with. And did you get to do that?
Oh, yeah. That was another one of those great ideas that, like a bowling ball, went right off the edge of the table.
Amazing.
When you're in the Foreign Service and you go to a new post, there is, everybody in the diplomatic corps knows who in which ministries you can talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be the minister here, but this is the guy who really gets things done. And it's sort of passed on. And so my suggestion was, well, we don't have an embassy in Baghdad, but a lot of our friends did. Why don't we just call our friends, have them talk to the people who
right.
have been in Baghdad and say,
right.
okay,
perfect.
You know, who in the mm-hmm. Ministry of Industry is any good? Who
right.
at the Ministry of Electricity
right, right.
is any good?
And did you start to do that?
We don't need to do that. It wasn't
you
even
weren't
done.
Allowed to do it. Oh, it,
we didn't, I couldn't even get a telegram, a cable, out to our embassies saying, could you please go into your host government, ask them if they have anyone who has served in Iraq recently who could just advise us on who should we talk to. We didn't even know where some of the ministries were.
Huh.
We were operating on, honest to God, a Lonely Planet's guidebook to Iraq.
Oh, no.
Absolutely.
Oh, no.
Absolutely.
I mean, literally.
Literally.
Literally
a Lonely Planet's, you know, the hippie's guide to Iraq.
Oh, no.
That's where we were.
And so supposedly you were in charge of Reconstruction, but in fact you had to clear everything with the Pentagon, right?
Oh, I wasn't, yeah.
But
I
not
was
the State Department. You're a State Department official.
I wasn't. For these purposes, we had been seconded to DOD. So I work for DOD. And I was the coordinator, but I wasn't in charge.
The Department of Defense. So everything had to go to the Defense Department.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Everything mm-hmm. went up to through. That was the only chain of command. And what was very clear very quickly was that the presidential decision in, I think it was January 20th of 2003, that gave the lead to the Department of Defense. If you read the language, it says that they're supposed to coordinate the interagency. It was read far more of we're in charge. Mm-hmm. And there was not the kind of interagency collaboration coordination that you would normally have in a mission like this. And I think, you know, defense did itself a grave injustice because there was a lot of talent out there. One of our big issues
including
was
obviously you.
Well, but there was a lot of talent. One of our biggest problems was how do you pay people? First of all, you have to pay people. You can't expect them to come to work and not pay them. Yeah. But paying this huge civil service was not as simple as it might seem.
Right.
Do you use Saddam's money?
Right.
Do you use Kurdistan money? Do you use U.S. money? What money do you use? What exchange rate do you use?
Right.
There are people at our Department of Treasury who do this kind of thing, who think these kinds of things. There have been other post-conflicts,
right.
East Timor, Bosnia, where right. people have wrestled with these issues.
Right.
So tap into this. And right. we kept trying to kind of invent everything for the first time, and it doesn't work.
And you weren't allowed to contact these other people?
Not the way we really should have. Huh. Getting experts to come out, it was very, very difficult. Even when other departments in the U.S. government identified experts, it was very hard to get them cleared to come out.
So when it became clear that the kind of mission you've been given to and the kind of team it just wasn't going to work, and they were going to send in their own people, how did that?
I think it was evident.
From the beginning?
Almost from the beginning, and that that this was going to be almost impossible, and that most of the problems that we were facing were self-inflicted. We all operated on the, you know, if we stay in here long enough and push long enough, and, you know, maybe we can make something happen. And it was interesting. I don't know anybody who quit. However frustrating and sometimes futile it looked, nobody walked away.
So how long were you actually in the job before they sent in Bremer and a new team?
Bremer came in on May 11th.
Uh-huh.
So Garner and his team were on the ground for about a month.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, of course, things started changing even more rapidly. But we saw even the first week we were there that some of the experts were being replaced. And the very first one was a man named Fred Burkle, who was a public health specialist and a post-conflict public health specialist, very special kind of background. And Fred was terrific. I mean, he had done this kind of thing in war zones before. And he just kind of disappeared one day, just wasn't around. It took a little while to figure out that he had been ordered home.
Huh.
And this man who knew what he was doing, had done this before, was replaced by a community, and Fred, by the way, was a medical doctor, was replaced by a gentleman who was a community health coordinator with no medical background, no post-conflict background, who had worked in a state that was, that the administration was very comfortable with, let's put it that way. And so all of a sudden we had somebody who was hired more for their loyalty than their expertise.
Right.
And this idea that an expert could not be loyal was, I think, one of the most corrosive concepts in this whole reconstruction.
Well, do you think that was essentially your problem? You knew too much, you were too smart, you actually knew the area and you...
Well, I think for across the board, what the military calls subject matter experts, people who knew the region, knew post-conflict, knew whatever, were fairly systematically, over time, replaced with people who were more ideologically, politically comfortable to the leadership. And there were people who were doing the hiring in Washington who were very upfront about this. I mean, they made no apology about this. They believed that loyalty was the most important aspect, and this is where I think it went off the tracks, was that for some reason experts can't be loyal. And those of us who you know, our career, foreign service, military, intelligence, civil service, whatever. You know, our loyalty, we like to say, you know, our oath is to the Constitution, but our loyalty is to, you know, the president, whoever that may be. This idea that it was an either or was something that I think most of us found, you know, just baffling, given this is what we do, this is what we've always done. But there was this idea that you could either be an expert or you could be loyal, and they opted for loyal, but it meant they didn't have any experts. And there's been some interesting books written already, and there will be more on...
So when you got the news that there was going to be a new reconstruction team coming in and you were going to leave, were you annoyed, relieved, not surprised, all the above?
Disappointed, I think. On one level, I wasn't terribly surprised, but I was very disappointed.
Disappointed personally or disappointed in what this meant in terms of the change in policies?
More disappointed personally, because I had really wanted to stay, despite the enormous frustrations. A little disappointed when we saw the breadth of the changes.
Tell us about that, taking yourself out of it for a moment. What did this mean in terms of the way in which the reconstruction was going, what in terms of the policy shifts?
Well, again, I think when we first heard that Paul Bremer was coming, I think a lot of us had this feeling that, well, he is a diplomat, he is used to dealing overseas.
Because he was also in the State Department.
He's in the State Department, he was a career diplomat, and that, you know, this actually might be for the better, that... Jay Garner's expertise was as a logistician, and those weren't the problems we were facing. We were facing political, diplomatic problems. So initially, it really looked like Paul Bremer would be a good choice. But as we started to see that the experts were being replaced by loyalists, and that I think when we all saw the demobilization order, the debathification order, a lot of these major decisions that were taken in May, and the decision to really try to run this out of the green zone instead of with the Iraqis. It was the exclusion of the Iraqis from the process, excluded from the military, excluded from the civil service, but also excluded from really being experts to us. That's when, you know, this is going to be very hard to pull off. We cannot do this in a vacuum or in a green zone.
I know even when I was there briefly in 04, I went to the green zone, it was like an American Army camp, and all the administrators were getting orders directly from the Pentagon.
Right, and even though it's now changed to an embassy, the green zone is so removed from Iraq. As I said, when I was there, I was going out of the green zone every single day. Now it's almost impossible to go outside the green zone. So it's becoming more and more disconnected from the reality of Iraq. And you're either dealing with Iraqis who have had to live in the green zone for their own safety, and they, of course, are somewhat disconnected. A friend of mine who is a Marine colonel and a really, really superb person, came back from his tour, and he said his frustration was that he saw Iraq through 4-inch bulletproof glass wherever he went. And he said, I literally had no contact with the Iraqis the whole time I was there. And I think that that's probably, you know, a good allegory for
Yeah, and of course the Green Zone is the old headquarters of Saddam's Republican regime, and so the symbolism of that is not lost on the Iraqis. One empire is being replaced by another.
Yes, but you know, in a way that we have the Green Zone probably more locked down than even Saddam did.
At least he went out in public from time to time.
Well, the Green Zone was not quite as much of a fortified camp as it is now, and It does sort of bespeak to how horribly disconnected we are from where we are.
We've obviously been following things that have happened since you were there.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of looking back at it, what do you see as kind of the biggest mistakes in terms of the reconstruction and lost opportunities? And of course, the inevitable question, what can we do now?
Well, that's the big one. You know, the kind of trying to roll back as to, you know, what... Taking aside the demobilization and debathification as sort of the two huge mistakes. I think if we had, even with those decisions, found a way to bring the Iraqis more into the process, into the political process, into the development process. We all know about the huge contracts, the Halliburton and Bechtel. If we had been doing reconstruction at kind of the low level using Iraqi contractors.
Using Iraqi companies,
using Iraqi labor, instead of building these edifices that cost millions and millions of dollars and don't work. I mean, if they worked, it would be one thing, but they don't even work. Politically, if we had brought the Iraqis more in, we were dictating this. We were we had an idea in our minds what we wanted to create, and I think that is a decision we could have taken anywhere along the line and might have had a different result. But what we have is an American presence and an American effort that the Iraqis don't see as having anything to do with them.
Right, and it's what, 78% of the Iraqis want the U.S. to get out.
And that's probably been there for a long time. It's very interesting, the very famous line that Vice President Cheney was using about roses and sweets and liberators instead of occupiers. The Iraqi who said that actually said that we will be greeted as liberators and occupiers for the first 10 days. And even he did not say it was going to be forever. And he was putting caveats that said, yes, you're going to be the liberators in the beginning, but then you have to be able to turn the power over. You have to be able to do all these other things. And we only kind of got the opening clause to that. And we never really focused on the rest of what this Iraqi, who was very supportive of the invasion, was warning us about. This was not a critic of the invasion. This was an Iraqi who was very encouraging of the, an advocate of the invasion. Even he was putting up these warning signs in '02.
And now fast forward to today, where do we go from here? I know that the Baker-Hamilton Commission people talked with you, and they talk with me also. They talk with everybody.
They talked with everybody.
I mean, I know especially with you because of your experience. And do they have it right?
I think the Baker-Hamilton report is about as close to right as anything I've seen. For a couple of reasons. One, it is a coordinated, consolidated strategy. It includes security. It includes development. It includes economics. It's regional. One of the comments, and I am drawing a blank on who said it right now, but that the surge is not what the president announced on January 10th. It was really not a new strategy. It was a change in tactics. Baker-Hamilton was a strategy. It was comprehensive. It was comprehensive. It was integrated. It was long-term. That is a plan. You know, a statement of intent is not a plan. And so I think that, you know, Baker-Hamilton at least was the core from which we should have been working. This, if you even take a look at the new Army Field Manual on Counterinsurgency that General Petraeus oversaw. I mean, he's sort of given credit for writing it, but I oversaw it.
Is he the right guy?
He's absolutely the right guy. Whether or not it's the right time might be too late. But counterinsurgency doctrine is that this is a political problem, not a military problem. That the solution is a legitimacy issue, not a security issue. If you look at what the military is saying, they are saying things that are very similar to Baker-Hamilton. Political, development, regional, diplomatic. And so there's not that much of it.
The military, the State Department, intelligence, Congress, everybody agrees with Baker-Hamilton, and yet somehow the president is still convinced that victory is possible.
He's the decider, and he has decided.
Is victory possible? Even the word victory, does that make sense?
I don't think that the word victory is the right word. First of all, it implies that this is a conventional military war. It's not. We're not going to destroy this enemy, whomever the enemy is or enemies are. We, if we are lucky, will have success, and we will be able to defeat them, but you're going to be defeating them in the broader sense of sort of basically taking away, you know, their justification, not destroying them.
Of course,
and
one.
We're still trying to operate on the, you know, Secretary Rumsfeld's famous snowflake about, you know, killing them fast enough. Well,
right.
You can't. You have to get at the roots of it, mm-hmm. and we're not. We're mm-hmm. still operating on...
So this is the ghost of Rumsfeld. Of course, one of the enemies potentially is Iran, and of course some have argued that the real reason for the surge is to intimidate Iran in some way, to try to deal with that potential enemy. Is Iran a real enemy? Do you think we're going to war with Iran?
Well, I certainly hope we're not going to war with Iran, because if we haven't been able to handle Iraq, we're certainly not going to be able to handle Iran. It's three times the size.
But even if it was an occupation, what if it was just a military, a strategic strike supposedly to take out the military capability?
Yeah, it's very interesting. President Bush repeatedly assures people that we're not going to invade Iran.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say anything about we're not going to attack Iran.
Right.
And however, he likes to think that he can excuse things by misspeaking. He's actually very careful on his words, and he has said we are not going to invade. He didn't say we're not going to attack.
Hmm.
Again, I think if you look at both Baker Hamilton on one side and the National Intelligence Estimate on the other, Iran is not the problem. I think the NIE calls it the accelerator.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not the problem. The sectarian violence is self-reinforcing at this point. The insurgency was probably directed more at us. Mm-hmm. Are the Iranians kind of fishing in troubled waters? Absolutely. If I had a border that long with a state that had been as much of a threat to me as Iraq has been to Iran, I would be very concerned about what was going on there, too. Mm-hmm. I don't think that provoking Iran is going to make the situation in Iraq any better, and it runs a very high risk of making it considerably worse.
Well, big picture question then. Mm. Let's say we're on a Baker Hamilton strategy. We're trying to rethink the Middle East. Do you think that the Middle East is always going to have a role for the U.S., or do you think that ultimately, and maybe sooner rather than later, we need to get out and let the Middle East be the Middle East?
Well, I think there's something in between that. We're not going to be able to walk away from the Middle East entirely. First of all, you know, I don't know how you got here, but I did drive. And as long as we're dependent on oil, we're going to be dependent on the Middle East.
Which is part of the problem, after all.
It is part of the problem, but I think it's overstated as part of the problem, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you didn't have that, major sea lanes go through there. You've got the Suez Canal, the Bab el Mandab, and the Straits of Hormuz. International commerce is dependent on that part of the world. Taking the problem bigger, most Arabs are Muslim, but not most Muslims are Arabs, but we are talking about an Islamic world of over a billion people. And I think people who think we can walk away from the Middle East think we can somehow walk away from the Islamic world, and that isn't going to work either. There isn't a part of the world, and we should have learned this from Afghanistan, that is irrelevant to us. It's also, there's a broader issue of the democratization and how people are living. I think what we need to do is recalibrate our relationship with the Middle East. I think we need to be dealing with them more as partners and less as pawns.
You mean not just Saudi Arabia, but also Iran and Syria.
I'm talking about the entire region. Mm-hmm. And we are not dealing with the region as a three-dimensional set of players. I'm very concerned about this new push to deal with moderates versus extremists, which sounds good, mm-hmm. except that the way it's kind of coming out is that it's really, we're trying to set up an Iran versus the rest,
right.
almost a Shia versus Sunni kind
right.
of Middle East.
Right.
And it's like what we didn't learn in Iraq, we're now not going to learn in the rest of the Middle
After
East.
After creating, of course, the possibility for a Shia power in Iraq, with
in
obvious
Iran.
Ties with
oh,
Iran,
yeah. yes,
and
yes.
it says building up that, and then
we're
going to say,
we
oh,
built
well.
It up, and then we're going to try to tear it down. But we're also, we have this fixation of seeing the Middle East in sectarian terms,
mm-hmm.
which the Middle East doesn't see itself in. I mean, mm-hmm. are people aware that they're Sunni or Shia or Christian?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But is it the primary identity? much less the sole identity that these people have. And they actually can handle multiple identities simultaneously. It's remarkable.
Baghdad especially, intermarriage between Shia and
Sunni. It's throughout the whole region. Mm-hmm. We're putting it into this almost Zoroastrian good, bad,
right,
using an identity that is only one of the identities.
Right.
We're not even dealing with the Middle East as nation states or nations. We're setting up a conflict that most people in that region don't want. So our intervention in the region is still belying a complete lack of understanding about even what I think these people want. And if we let this thing loose, I mean, if we take off the lid of this Pandora's box, we could end up with a Middle East that is a threat to the rest of the world, a threat to itself and a threat to the rest of the world. I'm a diplomat by training. I'm a diplomat by nature. It's why I wanted to do it. We should be engaging. We're not. We're putting people in boxes. We're ignoring them. We have this. We don't need to talk to the Syrians because they know what they need to do.
But exactly,
it doesn't work that way.
It's
very interesting that every former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, Republican as well as Democrat, James Baker, Henry Kissinger, they're all saying we should be engaging with the region. And it's almost as we get pushed to engage, the administration's response is to engage less. I think we can work, we should be able to work with Iran. It doesn't mean you're giving them a free pass. It doesn't mean you're saying that, you know, we even agree with what Iraq 5 or 10 years should be. We have differences on that. Of course we do. But we have a shared interest in Iraq not being a failed state, in this violence not becoming a contagion. Mm-hmm. Syria would like to have the Middle East stabilized. One of our very best friends, the King Abdullah of Jordan, has said that, you know, he looks around and he sees 3 civil wars. Our friends don't want this. And we need to be, it's interesting, the Saudis are working with the Iranians. The Iraqis reestablished diplomatic relations with Syria after 20 years. Everyone in the Middle East is talking to everybody else. Friends and foes, you know, despite our little bipolar approach, they're talking to each other.
It's time for us to get
it's
in the
time for us to get in the act. I mean, it isn't that it isn't going to happen. It's right. Happening without us.
Right. Sober conclusion and also with some hope as spoken diplomatically.
As.
Well, this has been a wonderfully illuminating conversation.
It's
so glad to
fun.
Have you back in Santa Barbara.
It's lovely to be back. Thank you so much.
Great to have you here.
Good. That was fun.
That was fun. It was a good conversation, right?
I know. Someday there's actually going to be a good line at the end of... Actually, you know, in retrospect, 2000 was probably the best year the Middle East has ever had.
Hmm?